All right, everyone, we can start in the next part here. We got transmitters past, present, and future. Our next presenter, Martin Horsepool, is the project manager for TV Transmission and Gates Air. Has been involved with transmitters and the like for about 44 years, so he has seen most everything to do with a transmitter in both past, present, and soon will be coming to the future. So, if you please, Martin Horsepool.
Well, thank you very much for the nice introduction. It's great to be back this year. I was here last year, and I believe the year before. So I ran out of topics to talk about HSE3, and everyone's tired of repack. So I thought I'd take a look at how television technology and transmission started, where it is today, what we're doing with it as we move forward, and my view of where it's going in the future. And it's just a brief view because it's very hard to predict the future, in my opinion, anyway. So let's move on. So on this slide, I found this slide very interesting. I've no idea exactly how old that transmitter is, or even if it's a radio or television transmitter. I suspect it's radio. The interesting thing about this picture is the dress code is three-piece suit and tie. So how many of you engineers actually wear a suit to work on the transmitter? Mark does, right, Mark? So I thought that was kind of cool. So moving on to, all right, let's try and move this forward. There we go. Who invented television? If you grew up where I did, in the UK, we knew about this Scottish engineer called John Logie Baird. And if you were to look at his method of television, it actually did scan, but it was a highly mechanical system. It had spinning wheels. It had to be exactly synchronized for everything to work properly. Probably needed a lot of light on the subject for anything to work at all. And it was incredibly low resolution by today's standards. So if you look at this diagram, the simple diagram of the happy viewer on the right, he has to kind of gaze through a screen that's getting a projected image from a neon light, or it's, you know, it's something that will glow and change brightness rapidly. So a neon light bulb was probably the best technology back then, long before LEDs and other technologies and cathode ray tubes, etc. On the image sensing device was really, basically, it's a revolving wheel with concentric spiral of holes in it that creates crude but slightly curved scanning lines of light being emitted from a fairly bright light bulb onto the subject. And then there's a, you know, an image sensing device which I put down as a photo cell, whatever that was in those days, something pretty crude. This was in the mid-1920s when this was developed. So you can imagine that the scanning lines are scanning the subject, basically, and the brightness is changing due to different levels of darkness and brightness. The voltage generated by that photocell will vary in small increments, and it can be amplified and transmitted over a radio transmission system, because radio was already invented. And that can be received by a radio receiver and turned back into something that makes the light blink on and off, or basically change in brightness with the actual subject. So if, as long as those two wheels were synchronized, everything works great. Resolution? Not so good. So NIPCO disc was actually invented long before television. So if you look, you ask who invented television, it's a difficult question, because television wouldn't exist without radio. So then you have to go back into the 1890s, you know, to when people like Tesla and Marconi were working on radio transmission. Without that, television couldn't have existed, and with parts and pieces like this were added, television got gradually invented. But mechanical television was incredibly non-robust, let's say, and impractical. So who really invented television? I think we have to give the hat to Mr. Farnsworth here. He was a Mormon farmer that basically... Philo Farnsworth, I've got to remember the guy's name. Philo Farnsworth was a Mormon farmer that, whilst he was plowing the fields, he saw these straight lines. He envisaged those lines to be scan lines and build up a picture. You know, it's kind of, you can see how he was thinking. And he was heavily into more of an electronic world. In fact, when he was a school kid, he was actually drawing image sensing devices. And, you know, this is a long time ago before such things actually existed. So I found that to be fascinating. So really, I think we give him the award for developing modern television, electronic television. So Here's an interesting picture, and I like this one because early television had tiny tubes, you know, they were round, circular cathode ray tubes. Back in the late 1920s and early 30s, people gathered around a small box, well, a big box with a tiny screen that was obviously black and white and had about 40 lines of resolution. Look how it's moved forward. Next year, this Australian company is introducing a 25-foot diagonal TV. It's outdoors because it's huge, it's bigger than this screen by far. Anybody that's got $1.5 million to spend can order one now. I went online, that website exists, it's not a joke. But what I find really, really interesting about this, going from smaller to bigger and higher resolution, is everybody still has a 3-inch television in their pocket. It's a cell phone, right? You could use it as an image viewing device, most people do. Everyone watches YouTube and Netflix and other things on small devices. So kind of like done a 360-degree turn here in terms of, you know, image, resolution's gone up and that will never go back down, but the size of the screen, maybe that's a bit too big for most people. So it wouldn't fit in most houses. All right, so moving on. Evolution of television. So television is less than 100 years old, you know. It started in the late 1920s, it was actually evolving into something that could be used. And by, what's the date here, 1928, we actually had real television. You know, you could actually broadcast it. So I think it was 1928, from the GE factory in Schenectady, New York, that she started broadcasting very low resolution television, obviously black and white in those days, but it was broadcast. It was really the first over-the-air television service that started. And as years progressed, you will see that technology's obviously progressed. We've gone from black and white to color. That was probably one of the biggest transitions. But the biggest one was probably going from analog to digital. You know, back in 1996, WRAL put something on the air, and there's your first high-definition digital television transmissions were started there, and it's progressed very quickly. And now we've got progression now in the last couple of years to HSC3, and this is the way we're heading. So digital itself is being advanced as we speak and go forward. So there's a lot going on in the world here with television. Let me look at the next slide. So on this slide, you will see that there's an evolution of transmitters. I picked Harris Gates air transmitters because I had pictures of them and I knew about when they were introduced. But you will notice that there's been a big shift here in technology. So in the early days of high power television transmission, everything was based on tubes, right? Tetrodes and triodes and things like that, onto klystrons and IOTs. But if you look at the modern transmitters, the way the trend has gone, everything's solid state. We don't make tube TV transmitters anymore. We haven't for several years. Maybe you can buy a tube TV transmitter, a new one these days, but I doubt it. I think most people have discontinued them. The advantages of solid state outweigh any benefits that tubes had. Tubes were good, you know, they produced a lot of power in one device. But with that comes its own, you know, issues, high voltage and reliability and so forth. So you can see progression to the right. Where's it going? It's a very interesting question. We will get to that. So the gentleman in the picture, his name's Earl McEwen. He worked for CPI. It was Varian in the old days. We used exclusively at Harris back then in those days when I was in field service, we used exclusively Varian klystrons. In fact, 5-cavity, integral cavity klystrons, which are big, enormous, expensive tubes, were pretty reliable. You know, they would work for many, many hours before you had to replace one. But when they failed, and, you know, where'd you get the new one, and how long does it take to install it? So it's quite a bit of work doing. But the biggest transition I'll note here is that the technology has advanced quite quickly from tube to solid state, and it's all ongoing. You know, there's a lot of improvements being made in things like efficiency, performance, reliability, you know, less maintenance. Those things are key to today's world. Engineering for TV transmission seems to be a little bit on the downfall. If you look at how many younger people are interested in RF, it's not that many. Everybody wants to work on computers and things these days, you know, so it's a moving target there. So tube to solid state, there is a progression of tubes here on the left. Eventually, we introduced transmitters at reasonably high powers. I'm talking in the analog days, 10 kilowatts, 20 kilowatts, even 30 kilowatts of peak sync power, if anybody remembers what that was, using bipolar transistors. Very good, broadband, worked excellently across the whole UHF band. However, low gain, we had a lot of drive stages, low efficiency. We didn't have very good high efficiency amplifier techniques, at least not in those days. But today's LDMOS devices, higher power in one device, so you use less devices to get to a very high power transmitter. And with proper amplifier techniques, the efficiency is much, much higher. So I have questions here, so who can answer the question? Which of those tubes did Harris or Gates there never use in a TV transmitter? I know Mark knows the answer. Which one is it, Mark? Diacrode, right, diacrode. I'll get back to that later. So the one that was never used, there was the question, I beat myself to the question, was the diacrode. And there were some reasons behind that, and I'll get to that later, but we already had pretty good products using IoTs. Efficiency was similar, so there was some differences in, obviously, in the transmitter design that we didn't want to get into at that point, so we'll just throw that tube away. All right, next. So that brings me to an interesting topic. What was tried but didn't work so well and never really made it to the market, at least big time? You know, you can see what was said there. And another thing is success is not final, right? There's always, failure is basically not fatal, it's the courage to move on. You always try something. If it doesn't work, you keep trying it, you keep trying it. You might make 10,000 mistakes before you find one really good solution. So that's the key here. Moving on. So, nothing wrong with Comark. I know the guys, I know Dick Fiore, I know all these people. I even know Perry Priestley, whose name is on the bottom of that paper that was published in 1995 at NAB, and there was a nice presentation on something called PS squared. What the heck's PS squared? So I have a copy of that paper, by the way, so I didn't make any of this up. Basically, it's a new style of beam supply. Tubes in those days, IoTs or klystrons, needed high voltage. These were IoT days, inductive output tube. And because the tube had a tendency to arc and spark if something went wrong, you had to shut down the high voltage as quickly as possible. So you had contactors on the front end, you had spark gaps to discharge all the capacitors, you had a crowbar. The idea was to eliminate the crowbar while doing so by using IGBTs, insulated gate bipolar transistors. You could step the voltage up, you could ramp the voltage up, you could shut it off quickly. They could eliminate step start functions, they could shut it off quickly, as I said, to remove the spark gap or the crowbar circuit. You could make a nice regulation scheme built into that so you wouldn't need voltage regulators. So they made a bold statement. You know, all of these things were relics of the past. The problem was none ever shipped, as far as I know. I could be wrong, but as far as I know, they were always demonstrated in the factory. What I think went wrong there was A, cost, B, reliability, and probably a lot of other things to do with it, like complexity and hard to repair if it breaks. So things that sometimes look good aren't always practical. We've learned that over the years. Something could work and, improve the design by eliminating the crowbar, which was a nasty thing to have on a high voltage circuit. It would go bang and everything discharges quickly. This was a great idea, I thought, but it never made it to market, as far as I know. So we'll throw that away. So what else didn't work? Okay, Acridyne. Company no longer exists, but the people are still around, as we know. They actually used the diacrode. The tube I said that Harris, Gateser never used over the years, we tested it. We had a look at it. We were a little bit concerned about some of its characteristics and worried about going back to a sort of a triode, tetrode type of device. It's basically a very, very high power vacuum tube with reasonably high gain, broadband and so forth. That product, the transmitter shown in this picture, was actually introduced. It was shipped. I know customers bought them. The problem with that was that in the end, it turns out the tube life was not that good, and people get tired of replacing tubes and buying them because they're not cheap. So even though the idea was good and it worked in those days in analog, this goes back to analog television, common amplification. You had one tube, could do 60 kilowatts of common amplification. When visual only, I think it was rated at 80 kilowatts. So for a very small tube, it was extremely high power. But the technology, I think, eventually died and those products went away. All right, what else have we got? Let's go.
Well, eventually I'll get it to move forward. Here we go. So, what did Harris do that didn't work? So we actually worked with Westinghouse, and they had these great devices based on silicon carbide. Silicon carbide used instead of just silicon or germanium or whatever transistors were made of at the time. And there were some advantages to silicon carbide. Higher junction temperatures meant the cooling was less critical. You know, these things would run hot and run well. You could make a broadband amplifier. It was pretty efficient. It looked like it was great. You could make 500-watt transistors out of silicon carbide because that extra junction temperature, the higher junction temperature, enabled that device to be operated at higher power and still be able to dissipate the heat into a heat sink. So we built a transmitter, a 1.5 kilowatt transmitter. We shipped it. We put it on the air in Seattle at KCTS. I think it lasted, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. And one day somebody turned it on wrong. There were two power supplies, and if they weren't turned on in the right sequence, of course we didn't think about some logic to prevent things happening that were wrong, it blew up all the transistors in one go. So that wasn't a good thing. So we sent one of our field service engineers, can't remember who it was now, it wasn't me, went in and replaced those amplifiers with regular MOSFET type amplifiers, and we gave up. We looked at this, and the problem we had wasn't the fact that that one blew up. The problem we had was that those devices had an incredibly low yield, meaning, you know, you get this wafer and you start making devices out of it, only some fraction of a percent of them actually worked. What that means is the cost per device was incredibly high, and as a broadcast transmitter manufacturer, we can't have the most expensive product. Maybe we still do, but anyway, in those days, we had very expensive transmitters. We didn't want the price to be three times that because the devices were very expensive, so we gave up. Maybe that technology will come back one day. All right, what else is interesting? One more. Throw that one away. Here we go. All right, so there's a company that actually used to sell transmitters in the USA. They gave up because we basically, us and Comark and others, outsold them pretty easily because the Japanese, although they made very good transmitters, weren't as good at supplying spare parts and technical expertise at in the right time zone and so forth. So, but one thing I found interesting was they designed a multi-step amplifier, which basically had devices to turn the RF on in steps to build up the waveform, as shown in that tiny little diagram over there. Let's see, I should have a pointer here. Anyway, I was going to show you. Anyway, it doesn't matter. There's a waveform there built up of steps of amplifiers that would basically build up, a bit like what we do in AM for DX transmitters, where you build the waveform up in chunks, then you filter it to get rid of all these steps because there's high-frequency artifacts in those transitions. You filter it, and you have an amplifier that can be about 50% efficient. That never made it to market either. That's failed. I don't know why. We had a picture of the, a picture of an amplifier. I have a leaflet with a few technical descriptions to it where I got the efficiency number from. Looks like they built a rack, a transmitter with a module in it. Looked like only one module, but it never made it to market. Why? Don't know. Probably it was very expensive. Probably they had a problem with harmonics and out-of-band radiation from all these quick steps in the waveform made up of each device switching on and off. So, you know, never made it. So there have been a lot of things over the years that I've been through, and you may have been through some of these, that never made it to market because they either didn't work right or they were just too expensive. Now, everybody knows about the present. Well, I'll run through some of these slides fairly quickly. If I were to ask any one of you, what's the most important thing when you're looking for a new transmitter, a TV or a radio transmitter would work for this. Some of you will say, well, I want the most modern technology because everybody wants modern. Some of you will say, I want the highest efficiency. That typically comes from the guy paying the power bill, right? Might be the finance department. They want the most efficiency. The engineer wants something that's serviceable, reliable, and good performance, the bottom three. And they can be juggled in different ways. But really, to have a successful product, television or radio, you need all of that, right? You don't want to use old technology because things become obsolete. And believe me, we run into this all the time. We've even had parts go obsolete while we're designing a new transmitter. You know, it's unbelievable. But you look at microprocessors and FPGAs and things, they come and go like popcorn. You know, they're here and they're gone. So we have to be very careful about using technology that's going to disappear. We try to pick parts that are going to be around for 10 years or more, right? And it's tricky. You know? The other thing is just come with proper design. You know, serviceability, reliability, and performance all come with just good electronic design. All right. So some of the things that we like to talk about, modern technology, the use of microprocessors. Everything has microprocessors today. Your phone has a microprocessor or several in it. Your microwave oven has a microprocessor in it. Your vacuum cleaner might, I don't know. But that's the way we're going. We use big parts like that. Where basically, the big parts turned into a small part. So micro has a lot of components in it. So does an FPGA, a field programmable gate array. We use SMT. Surface mount technology. I find surface mount technology is basically it's makes things smaller, so you can squeeze a lot onto a board nowadays. The problem you have with SMT is, can you fix it? If it breaks, it's pretty hard to fix. Most people don't have the tools or the skill or the training to fix an SMT. So we basically went to board replacement type of field service on things like that. So what else? Doherty PAs. Basically, we want to reduce energy costs because everybody knows the power bills are going up. Energy companies, power companies want you to reduce your consumption. So there have even been rebates in some cities and states. If you can prove that you've reduced your power consumption by X percent or X number of kilowatts, there was a time when rebates were available to help you do that. And that helped people buy new products too, so very nice. Mechanical design, we got to make the thing easy to build, easy to assemble, and easy for the customer to disassemble should he ever need to fix it. So those are the types of things we're looking at here. So how many microprocessors are in that transmitter? Can anybody guess? I'll give you a few clues. So that's the product. It has 38 kilowatts of output power, solid state. It's two 19-inch racks, about 6 foot, just over 6 foot tall. Has 60 power amplifiers. It has 60 power supplies for the power amplifiers. There's one per. It's dual exciters. And the answer is, anybody guess? How many micros are in that transmitter? No guesses. Okay. I will give you the answer, 129. So. Basically, there's one in each PA, there's one in each power supply, and there's a few more here and there in the exciters and control systems. So that's how many are in a modern transmitter. If you look back 20 years, there probably weren't very many, right? There may have been one in the control system or something, but there weren't very many. All right. So I'm having clicker problems here, but there we go. So here is an interesting, this is a photograph of a circuit board we're using in our exciter. This is the modulator board. It has a lot of parts on it. It's pretty complex. I'm not going to read through all the parts that are on it, but you can see there's a lot of pieces and components to that. How many layers are in that PC? A PC doesn't have to have two layers or one layer. It can have multiple layers. Anybody know how many layers are in a PC like that? No? Six is a good start. 16? Let's see. That's a 16. How do you know that? Excellent. Okay, 16, so there's 16 layers in that board. So that board obviously isn't really cheap, but if we make enough of them, the cost is reasonable. That is probably the most complex board in a TV transmitter right there. The modulation waveform is generated in that board, all right? So it's not simple. It's a little expensive, but hey. So Doherty amplifiers. So we have a question. When was the Doherty amplifier invented? Anybody know the year? 1930-something. Yes, by Mr. Doherty, actually, in 1936. So obviously, in those days, it was tube technology. It's pulsed RF application, where they had what I would call high peak-to-average ratios by today's terminology. And the Doherty amplifier overcame that problem. You didn't have to run these amplifiers in class A or AB or whatever was popular at the time. And the technique is pretty simple. And the reason why this has been successful in this market is that amplifier topology there isn't really any more expensive to manufacture than a standard class AB amplifier. There aren't very many parts to this. There's some quarter wavelength sections and some matching, impedance matching on the circuit board. But in terms of components, it's not that much more complicated, if any, than a class AB linear amplifier. The only real disadvantage to this is you see these lambda over four sections in there that are part of this combining network and on the front end of one of those amplifiers. One amplifier is actually biased or operated only the peak of the waveform. One is running at the main carrier average power. They're quarter wavelength, so that means it's frequency bandwidth limited to some extent. A lot of that can be overcome by very clever impedance matching and starting with low impedances at the device outputs and then matching it up to 50 ohms at the output. But There is an impedance and, a frequency bandwidth limitation to that technique, but it is used by probably everybody in television transmitters today. RF devices, there are many devices on the market, but most manufacturers use one or two or three devices that are currently available. One such company is Amplion, and they've designed some devices that are purposely matched or purposely designed for broadcast. They're pretty high power. They run on 50 volts DC. In our old days of bipolar, they were, 28 volts or something typically. These are 50 volts. That lowers the currents, which makes some of the design of the board a bit easier for a given power level, but also helps raise the power. There are now available or coming to the market some 65 volt parts too. We haven't tested those yet, but we're getting some, so the voltage is going up. Whenever you change the voltage, it changes everything else. The power supplies have to change and so on, so it gets a little bit more complex. We use a device like this, a BLF888E, is a relatively new device. It's been around about 3 years or so now, maybe four, from Amplion. It's asymmetrical Doherty, and I think I have another slide to explain that. But the Doherty backoff peak to main, that's the levels at which the two halves of this transistor peak, are saturating. The difference between those two power levels is almost 8 dBs, which is useful. Because if you look at the waveform for HSC1, the peak to average ratio is about 6 to 6.3 dBs. But when you go to HSC3, it's very close to 8 dBs. So it's almost ideal for that type of waveform. It gives you good efficiency. One issue is, can you cover all of UHF with one Doherty design? People claim they can do it. We have one that covers 470 megahertz to 750 megahertz, which is most of the UHF band. As everybody knows, in the old days, it went up to like 800 and something, 806 or whatever in this country. We can get to most of that with one design. But we found that with this device, the asymmetrical Doherty, it's better to have three bands. But we were lucky. We were able to make what we call band A cover all of the repack bands. So it goes from channel 14 to 36. So we're pretty good with that. So it's one RF amplifier. No tuning, no jumpers, no adjustments. You just plug it in. Right? Perfect. So there's a diagram showing the input and output characteristics of the two halves of the Doherty design. So the device has two transistors inside it. So the package has two devices, let's call it, inside it. One of them is going to operate at, if I can get this pen to work, here we go. One of them is going to operate at, going to saturate at the lower power. This would be the carrier amp or the main amp, and then one's going to hit the peaks. So they saturate at different amounts, and basically what you're getting is the average of both of those joined together, so you get very good efficiency across a wider power range, right? So you get a good efficiency across that peak-to-average ratio fairly well. The asymmetrical Doherty has a peak-to-average backoff of symmetrical of 6 dBs, and then the asymmetrical, because the two devices are actually operating at different power levels, the math gives you about 8 dBs of peak to average. So there's the numbers for you. I'm not going to repeat them, but you can see that the 888E device that a lot of people are using today, it's actually a pretty good device for future technology, HSC3, for example. So something mechanical. I wanted to point out one thing that we've done that I think is a good improvement. We used to make what we call this a cold plate. This is the bottom part of a liquid-cooled amplifier. It's a piece of aluminum machined with a groove in it where we wanted the coolant to flow. But to contain the coolant, we opted to put in a piece of copper pipe. Basically, we laid it in there, pressed it, flattened it, run it through some machines so it's nice and smooth. Then we put the RF pallets, the boards which are on a copper heat spreader on top of that device, on top of this plate. And the coolant runs conveniently. These copper pipes run underneath those pallets, under where the devices are laid, so you get very good thermal connection. The problem with that is it's a bit complex to make. There's a few steps to it. It's not cheap. And cost is everything here these days. It's not that efficient. There's quite a bit of restriction in the coolant path here. The tube has to be relatively small, or this box gets bigger. The plate gets bigger and wider, so you have to make this tube fairly small, which means you have higher pressure, bigger pumps, and bigger pumps means less efficiency of a system, so you have issues to deal with here. So we have, I don't think I'll have time to play the video, so I won't, but we have a process video here. What we've gone to is something called friction stir welding. We make this is done outside of our facility in Illinois. We don't have this equipment. Basically, we have a bottom plate, which is thicker, has a machine channel in it, which is wider, and it has some perturbations in it to help the flow sort of meander around, so it's not just linear, it goes from side to side a bit to help cool the metal better. So you get very good thermal characteristics from the aluminum over to the liquids. The liquid has less restriction because its channel can be relatively wide. And we just put another plate on top of it here, and the seam where that plate goes around it and in the center part is friction stir welded. And basically there's a tool that comes down, starts spinning. That tool goes in between the gap between the two metals, it melts it and moves slowly around that gap, and it welds it together. Great thing about that is it's the same metal. You're not adding a second metal to this aluminum. You're welding the two. You're basically fusing them together. This has worked incredibly reliably with no leaks, no problems. So, and that's also cost less to make than the one on the left, so we love that, right? Won't play the video because it'll take too long. All right, so efficiency improvements have been going on for years and years and years. And when I first started working at Harris, one of the first jobs I had was go and install a bunch of these things, a mod anode pulser. So if anybody here remembers analog, and I think most of you do based on the age group, yeah, Mark, you can explain it. So there's a sync pulse. It's what, 4.7 microseconds in width, right? And a sync pulse is the peak, because we use something called negative modulation, the peaks of this waveform are the sync pulses. There's no picture information in that sync pulse, right? I'm only talking about the video, not the audio part of a transmitter. There's no picture information. So we don't care what happens during that sync pulse, but you need that klystron in those days to operate at the peak sync power all the time to be able to handle those peaks, or the sinks get compressed, and everyone's seen what that does. You get nasty short sinks, and you can try to stretch them, but you're running into saturation. So what you do with that pulser is you raise the voltage, actually you change the beam current by modulating the anode. You don't actually raise the voltage, you change the beam current by about 20%. So it's 20% lower during the picture interval and only high during the 4.7 microseconds. So it's about a 20% power savings just by doing that. So that was the efficiency technique way back then. The efficiency technique today, Doherty amplifiers. There are other techniques. If I don't waste too much time, I'll have time to explain some of them. I wanted to show you how efficiency improvements, and this again, I picked our products, not trying to advertise anything, but I had the data, go from very, very low efficiency to, you know, in the range of 40% efficient. This is AC to RF, includes all the losses, the cooling system, the control, the everything. And it varies a bit depending on what channel you're on and, you know, a lot of little parameters here, but this, so there's a range, but you can see solid state isn't bad. We had some pretty efficient tube transmitters. This one used an MSDC IoT, which again is a, you know, big single tube type of device in the middle here that can have problems, right? It can arc and spark. So, you know, it's expensive. And anybody has an IoT transmitter of this type, there are some on the air, they will note that the tubes are harder to get and very, very, very expensive, right? Very expensive. So we like to have a more modular approach. Lots of parallel amplifiers. If one breaks, you just plug another one in, right? Everyone's doing it that way, so it's nothing unique to our company. Power supply technology has also improved. We used to make our own power supplies, the big horrible things. We used to get them done by some partners of ours too that were big horrible things. But nowadays, with telecom industry demanding lots and lots and lots of power supplies, conveniently at the same voltage that RF devices go, we can get very efficient power supplies. And that's a picture of a 3.5 kilowatt power supply that just plugs into the transmitter front. We're not the only manufacturer that uses this. Everybody else is kind of doing the same thing now. So, you know, you look at most products, not the German products, but the rest of the world is using these. So exciters, I want a quick one slide on, this is just ATSC exciters. I didn't go back to the beginning of analog. This is just ATSC. Look how many versions of ATSC exciters we've done. Went from this big thing that was four or five rack units that was sold for $72,000, Mark. I think you sold one to somebody once. So that thing was expensive. It didn't have any adaptive corrections, so it had manual adjustments to adjust the, you know, the performance, the shoulder levels and the, you know, the intermods and so on. We got better at it. We got better parts and pieces, and today we have a small one rack unit box that pretty much does everything. In fact, it'll do HSC3, so we're moving in the right direction here. What about the physical size? In Europe, it's not necessarily true here, but in Europe, they rent space in a building. There's some structure near the tower or in the tower that they have to pay per square meter. They want small transmitters. So the case here is I took two transmitters, an old HSC transmitter, this one, that'll only do, you know, 12 kilowatts, but it's three big racks and a control cabinet, to a two-rack transmitter that's, you know, almost a quarter, just over a quarter the size. So there's a lot of space savings in new products. That's also a good thing. All right, so the final topic I have, and this isn't, I don't have a lot of slides on the future because the future is a bit tricky to predict. I'm afraid I missed the presentation yesterday on the future of broadcasting that was early yesterday, but I wasn't here. But where are we going in the future? It's a bit hard to predict, I think. The big transistor. Okay, so there are bigger transistors on the horizon. In fact, we've already got one in the lab that's bigger than the ones I just showed you. It does more RF. It's more power per device. And that's a great thing, because if you have less transistors to get to some power level, there's less combining stages, there's less parts, there's less circuit boards, there's less. It becomes more cost effective. So that's good. We've got other, other device technologies. All right, what about GaN devices, gallium nitride? Well, we know of one manufacturer that's using them. I think it's Continental in Dallas. They have a GaN device UHF transmitter. We are investigating this, but the problem we see is the cost. You know, basically GaN devices are still a little bit limited in max power level per device for UHF. They're primarily used in microwave, you know, higher frequencies than the UHF TV bands. So there's, I think there's a little bit more work to do there to get the, you know, the dollar per watt ratio just right so that we could actually use them instead of LDMOS. They do have some advantages like high gain, very linear, so there's some advantages there. Silicon carbide I already talked about, so maybe that will come back. People have talked about diamond substrate devices and things like that, or some combinations of these. But I think everything we're working on is to do with higher efficiency as electricity costs going up. We're looking at other techniques. We've already done and demonstrated and shown at NAB drain modulation. That means we adjust the DC voltage to follow the track, the waveform. That's complicated because you have to track the waveform exactly time-wise, but it also causes phase changes in the RF, so you have to compensate for that. It's quite complicated circuitry and not cheap, right? So there's some things that we're always evaluating new things as we go forward, of course. So there is a paper that was presented by Jeff Mendenhall at some NAB when quite a few years ago now, 8 years ago, wow. But it was all about study of comparison of efficiency of, you know, and enhancement techniques for RF power amplifiers. That's actually worth, you can download that from that, you know, you can go search for it, but if you search for it from, it looks like it's our website, yeah, you can still find that paper, you can download it and read it. It actually goes through all of these techniques. It's quite interesting. I mean, Doherty, I showed you a two-way Doherty. You can do a three-way Doherty or a four-way Doherty with more stages per amplifier to break that waveform up into different amplifiers at peak or saturate at different power levels. You can raise the efficiency even higher than we are today, but there's a cost attached to that. So there's things ongoing there that can be tricky. So we're trying to reduce maintenance. So the point I'm making here is we could probably, with today's technology, there's a lot of microprocessor power available, computing power, we can design transmitters that basically can automatically set themselves up. We already have adaptive pre-correction. An adaptive pre-correction in the television world is you take samples at the output of the system, you feed them back to the modulator. The modulator recorrects it. Basically, it knows what the perfect waveform should look like, and it adjusts parameters to make the output resemble the perfect waveform. We're already doing that. You could do other things to improve setup, so you didn't have to do power calibration manually. Maybe there's a way to automate things like that. There's lots of things we could do. We're basically trying to reduce maintenance, because one thing that we've noticed in this world is there are fewer and fewer transmitter engineers. I know you hate to hear that, because a lot of you are, or were. There are less people seemingly in that business, so we want to make it easier. We want to make this thing easy to diagnose, easy to troubleshoot, and easy to fix. So, you know, those are the types of things that we're looking at. We're even looking at doing things like outdoor transmitters and things like that, where you don't even need a building. You can bolt this thing to the side of a pole. That works for low power stuff pretty well. High power, yeah. I think we're still a ways from that. This is where I had to think outside the box a little bit. So, you know, how long will over-the-air television broadcast exist for? How long will it exist for? It's hard to say. I think HSE3, as we know, is coming. So HSE 3.0, you've already heard some presentations on that. It's definitely coming. It'll eventually get, you know, it'll eventually replace, I believe it'll replace, you know, HSE 1, obviously. At the moment, it's the most advanced waveform out there, the most advanced technique, IP-based, you know, spectrum juggling. Will there be another auction one day? Who knows? You know, we never know. But I foresee that the telecom business, with ongoing development and 5G, is growing and growing and growing. There'll be more demand for spectrum, right? Already basically lost a big chunk of UHF. What's the next chunk to go? And as we improve modulation techniques and video and audio compression techniques, we can get more programs into one channel anyway, so maybe you can get by with less RF. It's possible. You know, what's going to happen in 10 to 20 years? RF's still around, HSC4, whatever. You know, there could be something newer and better. I don't know if that will ever happen. 5G, 6G, 16K resolution, if anybody needs it. I don't think so, unless you're going to run a cinema completely electronically. Cable disappears. That's just a suggestion. I don't know if it will. What about in 50 years? You know, now we got television transmitters on Mars, right? Now I'm thinking really ahead. No need for broadcast. Just implant something in your head, and you can pick it up by some kind of extrasensory perception, maybe. So it's hard to think too far into the future for me. I won't be around in 50 years, so, you know, I don't have to worry about it. So, you know, the question is, how long will RF be around? Everybody knows the answer to that. Forever, right? And I said at least for another 10 raised to the power of 10 to the 126. And I got that date from something on the internet, so that's the end of the universe. So however many zeros that is after the 10, but that's when there's no energy left. Everything's gone. So there's no RF at that point, right? So that's kind of my, that's my forever thing. So I had one slide on what to look for in a new exciter, since that was in my in my notes that I sent in on this presentation. So there's a few things there. I'm not going to read them all out to you, but you probably want to make sure your exciter is future-proof. You know, will it work with future modulations? As far as we can see ahead, obviously HSC3 is good to have. It has IP, direct IP inputs, so you don't need any converter. You just, you know, everything's ready to come from your head end or your scheduler, framer, HSC3 box. So all of these aren't all GateSair products. All manufacturers are headed that way. If they haven't already, they're going that way. So we have one more question for everybody, I think, if I can get this up. So which of these definitely cannot operate in HSC3? Which of these? It's obvious, right? Hang on. Let's see if I can click it one more. That one, because that's a brick. That's a piece of concrete. But everything looks like a brick, right? So anyway, so I thought I'd end of a bit of a joke. But anyway, thank you very much for listening, and I'm open to any questions that anybody has. Thanks. Oh, Mr. Felig.
One line makes me question. Cable disappears.
Ah, yeah.
Bear in mind, cable's more than coaxial wire or even fiber. It's the ownership of programming. And right now, ATSC3 can put a lot of programming out, but not if it's owned by Time Warner or big media companies. So it's both. And I think the business end of that's going to keep it around.
Yeah. Good point.
I didn't know what you intended.
Yeah.
Well, were you looking more at the coaxial cable, Mr. Belden?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I agree. You're right. Cable will probably not disappear totally. It depends on what the terminology is for cable.
Something else, wired media or something. And some of that will be wireless, too.
Yeah. Thank you. Any more? All right. Thank you, everybody.